Hey y'all, I'm Carrie.
Hey y'all, I'm Mandy.
And this is Monstrous.
This episode contains topics and language that may not be suitable for all listeners, and topics that may be triggering for some. Listener discretion is advised.
Okay. Anything we need to talk about, discuss before we jump in?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. I don't think so either. Nothing new as of right now anyway.
No, not yet.
We'll see what happens.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is our last episode for Women's Appreciation Month. And I counted our episodes, including the spooky episodes. This episode will make 32 episodes.
That's crazy. I can't believe it's been that.
Right? I counted them. I was like, there's no way it's been that many already.
It doesn't seem like we've done that many.
It doesn't. It's crazy.
I know.
So it's definitely been a learning curve.
Yeah.
But I think for the most part, we've got to figure it out. At least until we get the pod room or whatever we're going to call it set up and we start doing videos, and that's going to be a whole nother thing.
That would be another learning process.
Yeah, because I don't know nothing. Well, I guess I didn't know anything about any of this stuff either, which I have it wrote down. We've got to start figuring out how we're going to decorate it, what mics we want, and all that.
Yeah.
So we can work on ordering all the stuff so that way when it's ready to set up and that extra room we have is cleared out, then we have everything. Okay, so anyway, to why we're here and why everyone is listening to us, because they are not listening to us to hear us talk about how many episodes we have.
Right.
Or our pod room. Okay, so just like last month, I have two cases to end this month with. Both of these women were trailblazers. Both are still inspirational, outstanding, and true role models for young girls, because, woof, do they need better role models? But I'm going to do it a little differently than normal. Instead of me telling you in the order in which I wrote the two cases, I'm going to let you pick which one you want to hear first.
Okay.
So, for the first case of today, do you want me to tell you about a woman that's been dubbed the real-life Olivia Benson, a nurse turned FBI profiler, or about a woman who went from a police matron to a city's first female detective that helped crack one of the city's most riveting armed robbery cases?
Hmm. I think the first one.
Okay.
Yeah, the first one.
Okay. This woman was, as I said before, a trailblazer in her field. The work she did in the true crime world had her up to her elbows in a world no woman had ventured before. I, myself, find her very inspiring, and I'm pretty sure you will too. So this woman has been dubbed the real-life Olivia Benson and known as the female Mindhunter and Sherlock Holmes with a skirt, which says it all.
Nice.
But there's so much more to her. So, without further ado, this is the Anne Burgess story. Anne Burgess was born in 1936 in Newton, Massachusetts. She grew up during a time when women really only had three career choices. That was to be a teacher, a secretary, or a nurse. For Anne, the clear choice was to become a nurse. Having grown up with doctors for uncles and other medical professionals, there was no other option for her to even consider. And so, Anne began her studies at Boston University with her eyes set on a nursing degree. As part of that nursing program, as is with any program, she had to complete a set number of hours in a clinical setting, learning hands-on with real people rather than dummies. She decided to complete these hours at the Massachusetts Mental Health Center. Anne had decided to go into psychiatric nursing because according to her, she was fascinated by human behavior. She further said that as a nurse, she was told to focus on the medicine and treatment, but she wanted to hear about how people felt their feelings, their behavior, and their reactions. It was in this way that Anne began working with sexual assault victims. Anne would listen to their stories. She studied how they behaved and their interactions, as well as when they told their stories. While she worked with these victims as much as she could, she would go on to finish school and graduate with her doctorate in nursing science in 1969. Following this, she was introduced to Dr. Linda Holmstrom, who was a sociologist at Boston University. So at this point, Anne is a board-certified clinical nurse, and she's also a researcher. And at this time in our story, she's working on sexual assault survivor research and treatment. As a part of this research, she extends the original project to something much more than she had ever planned for it to be. Partnering with Dr. Holmstrom, they did extraordinary work modernizing the way in which we understand sexual assault. Because at the time, the mindset was very much blame the victim if the sexual assault was even acknowledged. And these two women set out to change that. Together, they founded a counseling program at Boston City Hospital, where they interviewed rape victims and then used their findings to publish a groundbreaking study in the experience of rape victims. This story included the interviews of 146 victims. Wow. And they ranged in ages from 3 to 73 years old.
Oh my God.
They then published those findings in an article called The Rape Victim in the Emergency Ward in 1973. This article was the very first of its kind because no one before them had studied this. No one had batted an eye at rapes or the effects that it had on its victims. So like I said, during this time, rape was completely seen differently than how we see it today. Back then, if it was acknowledged at all, it was blamed on the woman rather than the person that did it. In this study, Burgess and Holmstrom had been able to connect and attribute nearly all rapes to power and control, which, like we know now, nearly every rape is done in order for the perpetrator to feel powerful and as if they're in control. Along with this, they presented what is known as rape trauma syndrome. And this is the framework for understanding how victims react to assaults. These findings showed that nearly every rape victim is filled with anxiety. At times they feel and even express self-blame, and sometimes even having physical reactions like muscle tension. So these two women were really bringing out a lot of significant things. And because of them, today we see rape, victims of sexual assault, and the reasons behind these assaults very differently than we once did. Their work impacted the way law enforcement and others in power would treat victims. And they also changed how society understood what it truly was like to be victimized in this way. The work these two put into this research was so significant that one day in 1978, Anne would get a call from someone she had never expected to hear from. And this call would take her life in an entirely different direction than she had ever planned for. So in 1978, Anne received a call from William Webster, the director of the FBI. Anne received this call while working at the university. She had told her assistant to just take a message. Her assistant came back into her office and said, "You may want to take this call." Anne took the call. She was invited to come up and speak with the FBI because they had a serial rapist and they needed her help to catch him. They wanted to understand these offenders better, not really caring about the victim. They just wanted to know, how do we figure out who the offender is without knowing who it is?
Like profile them.
Exactly. And they had believed that if Anne could convey what the victims were experiencing in the way that she did, then maybe she would be able to help the agents understand the type of offender they were looking for. Agents didn't have training in this kind of area. So Anne would really have to teach them everything. From exactly how to understand and profile their victims to then use that information to then profile the offenders without knowing who the offender was. So profiling isn't used on its own to solve crimes. It's a very useful tool to use, but you can't just use a profile because profiles aren't always right.
Right.
So there are several types of profiling. So before I continue with Anne's story, I'm going to explain these types a little bit so that you and the listeners understand a little bit more about, you know, what they do and what's going on. So, like I said, there's offender profiling. And this is building a profile of the offender by looking at the facts of the case, such as behavior towards victims, the crime scene, the mode of offense, like, you know, rape, murder, robbery. Investigators can also use information from law enforcement as a profiling tool as well. Then you have victim profiling, which is when investigators identify characteristics of the victims themselves. This is also often known as victimology. And in many cases, especially serial cases like murder and rape, having the victimology or the victim profile helps to build that offender profile. So those two really go hand in hand. So I know victimology, like on the surface, it sounds like you're blaming the victim just because of the terminology. But once you dig into what it is and what it does, that's not what it is. It's just a bad name. But by building a victim profile, you're learning who the victim is. So that way you can better understand what happened and why the offender chose that victim rather than someone else. So like Ted Bundy, for example, all of his victims looked the same.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, they all had brown hair, white women, and they were able to use the fact that his victims looked very, very similar to then create a profile for who he was, which all of his victims looked like his ex-fiance.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Talk about creepy. Anyway.
Yeah.
So you also have DNA profiling, which is just simply using DNA to identify the offender. That one's simple. Then you have crime scene profiling, which is where they use the crime scene to learn about the type of offender. So, for example, you know, is the crime scene disorganized? Did they bring a weapon or use what was at the scene? Did they stage the scene? Those types of things can be decided based off the crime scene. You know, are they disorganized, organized? Was this a crime of opportunity? Was it planned? Things like that. Obviously, there's a lot that a crime scene can tell about an offender. The best way to look at crime scene profiling is that it has a story to tell. Because just like every victim, every crime scene tells a story of what happened, who did it, and how they did it. You just have to look close. Then you have geographical profiling, which this one is a little bit more modern. I believe this is the most newest type of profiling. Have you ever heard of geofencing?
No.
Okay. So it's basically you're using the geog to profile the offender. So this includes, you know, elements of like distance, mobility, locality. The best way to explain it is if you have a series of murders with the same MO that are all geographically found along a specific route and at truck stops, the most likely career of your offender would be a truck driver or some similar career that keeps them moving in these specific areas. And most offenders, they stay within their comfort zone. So typically your offender is going to live somewhere close to where people are going missing. Not always, but typically. So in murder cases, these sites are often called dump sites. They can provide information like the next body location. So if you find five different bodies with the same MO, they're all dumped at a truck stop, most likely your next body is going to be found at a truck stop along that route somewhere. Which I know dump body site isn't necessarily the sensitive way of saying that's the location of a victim's body, but that's the terminology. So there's other types of profiling, but those are the major ones that are used today. So this profiling is extremely helpful when it comes to solving cases. Sadly, it can also hinder a case because sometimes a profile can be wrong. It's not an exact science, and it's improving day by day. That's all that anyone can do. Okay, so now back to Ann's story. So we left off in the 70s with Ann being invited to come in and speak with the FBI because they needed her help. So at this time, the famous BSU or Behavior Science Unit, like what you see on the show Criminal Minds, that's an actual unit within the FBI. They had been newly formed as a response to the increase of sexual crimes and murders across the country. The BSU was headed by FBI agents John Douglas and Robert Ressler. These men were the first to coin the term serial killer, and they were the first ones to study serial killers like John Wayne Gacy, Ted Bundy, and so on. They had actually used killers like these to designate types of offenders. So disorganized, organized, those types of classifications. They used men like John Wayne Gacy, Ted Bundy to make those classifications. And these men are the ones that wanted Ann's help, but they weren't sure if she would want to work with the country's worst offenders. And this wasn't an easy decision for Ann. She had four small children at home, and she really didn't have any interest in the offenders. She wanted to help the victims. Ann recalled that in this decision, she had to consider her kids because she was already working full-time at the university as the dean of nursing. So she already had a full plate. And she was already very well accomplished. She really didn't need the FBI to back her up.
Right.
Her husband, like her, also worked in academics. And he was extremely supportive of her choices. He was like, well, if that's what you want to do, do it. But really, it came down to she just didn't have any interest in the offenders. In the end, though, she decided to do it. Because by doing this, by learning about the offenders, it would ultimately help the victims. And so she began her work with the BSU. She insisted, though, that her work be done on a research base, that it would be collected methodically and then published as a research paper. These were her requirements. And she said that was what the problem was. They began to do these interviews, and they started with some very significant offenders. They didn't have a questionnaire that they passed out. They went face to face asking these offenders the questions they wanted answers to. So have you watched the show Mindhunters?
No.
Okay. I think I watched a couple episodes of it, but I couldn't really get into it. So it's just like an interrogation. They just sit there face to face. That's how they found out what they needed to find out. The problem for Ann wasn't who they were interviewing. It was more of how they did it. The investigators had the idea of what they needed to find out and what to ask, but it wasn't organized. There was no real method to it. They just kind of went in and blurted out questions. So with Ann's help, they were able to hone in and develop their method. She helped them create driven questionnaires. She also fought and received a grant from the Department of Justice to meet with and interview these offenders. In total, through her work with John Douglas, they met and interviewed 36 different offenders, all in their efforts to learn more about them and their victims to be able to build profiles. Which, do you know who John Douglas is?
I don't think so.
Did you watch the TV series The Killer Next Door?
Yes.
He's the FBI agent in that show.
Okay.
Okay. So it was from this work that they were able to get the original classifications of serial killers. So like I said, organized, disorganized, those. And those two were actually the original classifications. They were the very first ones to be established. So Ann was brought in to help them establish these profiles. They brought her in specifically to help on a serial rape case. This rapist was dubbed the Ski Mask Rapist, which these fucking names, man.
I know. They're insane.
Like, I don't like whenever they give them these freaking stupid names, but then you give them awful ones like this.
Like, it's,
who is writing this shit? Because it's awful. So, anyway, this offender had sexually assaulted 80 women from the 1970s to the 1980s.
Holy shit.
Yeah. His crimes began in Louisiana, and most of his attacks were focused there, but it crossed state lines. A total of 12 states. And that's when the FBI got involved, because now that it's crossing states, it becomes a federal crime. So, now the FBI is tasked with finding and stopping this serial predator. This was when the BSU stepped in to create an offender profile. These offenders' crimes began as robberies, but then they escalated to sexual assaults, which told the BSU that they needed to be very concerned and they needed to work fast, because if he escalated once, it's possible he would escalate again. And this wasn't the only alarming escalation either. The offender went from targeting females that were alone to targeting females whose partners were at home at the time of the attack. With this escalation, the offender would debilitate the woman's partner and then make him watch helplessly as he assaulted the woman.
What the hell?
Yeah. So the authorities of all branches were stumped for quite a while because the man was really good at evading identification and obviously arrest. So this was when the FBI contacted Anne. They asked her to interview the victims and see if she could come up with some kind of commonality between them. She was nervous, but she agreed to do it. When she arrived in Louisiana, the local authorities actually thought she was an impersonator because she was a woman. Like, that's the time that she lives in where it's just mind-blowing to believe that a woman is working for the FBI.
Right.
They called to verify who she was because they didn't believe her.
Yeah.
So once they do that and the resistance to believe her and then to allow her to speak to the victims was gone, she was able to get some pretty good information from those that had been assaulted. And now she was able to come up with a profile. Part of that profile included the offender's focus on wealthy victims. And then through his behaviors, through things like what he said, how he acted, she was able to confidently say that the offender was a confident man. He came across as an alpha male, and he was highly adaptive. She was able to say he would most likely have a military background, and there was a high chance that he drove a very flashy car, which the car bit would be extremely helpful for local police and would ultimately lead to his capture. So one night, an officer noticed a flashy red Pontiac Trans Am in the area during a reported assault. He decided to take note of that car because the profile that had been sent out included the flashy car detail. With that information, police were able to identify the owner of said car and brought him in for questioning. And he pretty quickly confessed to having committed over 80 robberies and sexual assaults.
That is crazy. 80? Over 80?
Mm-hmm. This man's name was John Simonis. I think it's how you say it. S-I-M-O-N-I-S. Simonis?
Simonis?
Simonis? I'm not sure. Following those confessions, he was charged, arrested, and convicted. He received life in prison. So Anne is now today credited for these events that led to this arrest. But at the time, she was only credited to a certain degree. Because, you know, she's a woman, so of course, the men got the real credit. Even though they didn't do shit, couldn't have done it without her. So this arrest was a major win for the BSU. But was it a one-off, or could they do it again? Well, 2 years later, they would get their chance to prove one way or another, when Anne once again teamed up with Robert Ressler, who was the head of the BCU, on the case of two murdered boys in Nebraska. So I want to say that this one is rough. I'm going to give some detail, but I'm going to try to keep it not so graphic. In 1983, 13-year-old Danny Joe Eberle went missing and shortly after was found murdered. Less than 3 months later, 12-year-old Christopher Walden went missing, and he too was found shortly after, and he also had been murdered. Both boys had been stabbed multiple times, bound with rope, stripped, and mutilated before their deaths. Both crimes had sexual aspects, but they did not involve any type of sexual penetration. This would be important for the profile that they would go on to create. The original profile was done by Ressler, so the head of the BSU, which did lead to an arrest, okay? But the suspect arrested, it would come out, did not have anything to do with the crime.
What?
The profile that Ressler had done was revised by Ann. This time, the profile was very different. This go-round, with Ann's help, the profiler said the offender's mutilation and sexual-motivated crime without penetration most likely was a reflection of his own self-hatred due to his own sexual orientation. Some eyewitnesses had got a partial vehicle description, but the two believed that the offender would most likely be found at schools, in a church, or in a scout leader position. So in other words, they believed the offender was someone the boys knew. They trusted, having met him through school, the Cub Scouts, or possibly through church. This profile was released to the public, and then quickly after its release, a woman wrote down a plate of a very suspicious car cruising around outside her preschool. The driver saw her, circled back around, then threatened her. She was able to run away, lock herself inside the school before he could harm her. She, of course, called police, who responded immediately. A search of this man's car would result in them finding ropes that matched the rope found at both crime scenes. And also said this man would have detective magazines in his possession. And when they searched his home, they once again found out she was correct. This man was 21-year-old scout leader John Jobert. He was arrested and convicted of both murders and then later executed for his crimes. The BSU received more deserved praise for their work. This was a profile offender matched to a T. And this meant that they had proven that their first go-round was not a fluke, that they could profile and then identify offenders all based on what they knew from the victims and the crime scenes. And shortly after this, Anne was once again on the case, working this time on a child abduction case. This time, things were very different. Anne was tasked with interviewing a young victim, and the stakes were much higher. In this case, 2 7-year-old girls had been kidnapped in a suburb of Illinois in 1985. Their names were Missy Ackerman and her friend Opal Horton. So Opal had been able to escape by jumping out of the car window, but Missy was still missing. Anne knew the girl was very young, that she was brave and lucky to have survived, but they needed to get information in order to save her still missing friend. Police were out there looking for Missy, but they were doing it the old-fashioned way, running plates, talking to witnesses, all of that. And Anne felt like they were ignoring this young girl, the one who had been so close to the abductor. They were ignoring the survivor sitting right in front of them who could give them valuable information. But Anne wasn't dismissive of the fact that this little girl had just faced and survived a very serious trauma. So Anne chose to focus on interviewing little Opal. Anne said oftentimes she would have victims draw what happened to them during interviews. She said that she had found it helped relax them in stressful situations. And by doing this with Opal, she was able to see what happened to the girls and was even able to get a composite sketch of the assailant and his car through what Opal had told Anne, as well as what she had drawn. Both what she said and what she drew led to the capture of a man named Brian Dugan. Unfortunately, they did not find him in time, though. Missy had been murdered by the time they were able to catch him, and her body was discovered shortly after. Brian Dugan was a serial rapist who was convicted and sentenced to death. He would later have his sentence commuted to life in prison without parole. So now we're going to jump to the late 80s. Anna's worked on many cases with the BSU that led to the identification, arrest, and conviction of many offenders. And by this time, many of her colleagues were moving on. They were retiring, writing books, and so on. So it was at this time that Anne decided she would move on too. and her next endeavor would be quite controversial and would make her former colleagues very unhappy. There is no case that Anne worked on that is more famous than that of the Menendez brothers.
What?
Anne had testified for the prosecution in many cases. But this time, she was contacted by the defense, and she agreed to interview one of the brothers. Anne spent about 50 hours interviewing Eric Menendez. Her colleagues were not happy about her choice to do this. They cautioned her that working for the defense was a bad move, but Anne didn't agree. And after those 50 hours, Anne came to the conclusion that Eric had, in fact, been abused by his father, Jose, for years. And I mean, she was right about everything else.
Right.
And although she did not condone the murder of his parents, she did feel that it was very important to speak to the motives behind his choices. She further thought that it was important to give male victims a voice, just as she did female victims, which I have to agree with.
Yeah.
They didn't make the right decision, but knowing the abuse, to an extent, you can understand why they made that choice. Don't condone it, but it's kind of on the fence things. It's hard to really pick a side when it comes to that case. So as we all know, the brothers had two trials due to the first ending in a hung jury. The second trial, Anne was not allowed to testify because the judge ruled that any evidence of abuse would not be allowed in the trial. Or at least no sexual abuse evidence would be allowed. I can't remember exactly which one it was, if it was just sexual abuse or abuse in general. But either way, due to the judge's ruling, she did not testify the second time around. Which me personally, I do not agree with. The prosecution doesn't have to present a motive, but the motive that they presented was that the brothers just wanted their dad's money.
Right.
And that's not what it was. They were abused by their father, and whether it was the right choice or not, they felt that that was their only way out. You just took away a huge part of their defense. Now what are they going to do?
Right.
So Anne does not regret her choice in interviewing or testifying for them. She feels very strongly about giving male victims their voice, just as female victims have a voice. So following this, Anne would take part in another well-known trial. Anne would go on to help Andrea Constan, a victim of Bill Cosby. She helped her recall key details from her assault that would go on to help convict him in his first civil trial and then in his criminal trial. So Anne has a huge and significant legacy behind her. So far, Anne pioneered the field of forensic nursing, which are nurses that treat victims of crimes and traumatic events, with the majority being domestic violence cases, sexual assaults, and other forms of abuse. These nurses document injuries, collect evidence, and usually testify in court. Anne still teaches a full load at Boston College, where she still conducts research projects, including one on missing and murdered Indigenous women, which she is currently working on. Anne has went on to publish books with Douglas from the FBI, along with Ressler, about crime classifications, patterns, and motives in sexual homicides. So you said you've never watched Mindhunters. So in this show, it's very loosely based on like how the FBI BSU unit came to be. Story, how it's created, all of that. It's very loosely based on that. But there were some key people in the FBI and in this story that are portrayed in that show. So Bill Tench, who is the older FBI agent that was researching serial killers, was inspired by Robert Ressler. The female character, Dr. Wendy Carr, who they bring in to help them, was inspired by Anne Burgess. There's also a documentary on Hulu called Mastermind: To Think Like a Killer.
Oh, I've seen that.
Is it good? I haven't watched it.
Yes, it really is. I've seen that.
I want to watch it, but I haven't watched it. Yeah, that is based off of her and her story and all of that.
Yeah, you have to watch it.
Yeah, I'll have to get on there and watch it. Anne has been awarded many awards and appointments, and she's been published in books that she herself did not write. So before I end this one, I'm going to throw some numbers at you, because, you know, I always do that. So as we all know, policing is a male-dominated field, as it always has been. Only about 13% of police officers are female. But when you look at the FBI, that number is shockingly much higher. About a quarter of all agents are females. And around 60% of those female FBI agents are intelligence agents.
Oh, damn.
Yeah. So we can't discuss women in the force and in the FBI without mentioning the women that broke through that glass ceiling. The very first female FBI agent was, well, there's two, was Joanne Pierce Misko and Susan Rowley Malone in 1972. In the 1920s, under the direction of J. Edgar Hoover, who was the first director of the FBI, so President Hoover, before he was president, was director of the FBI.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, a lot of people don't know that about him. I have learned recently. I've known that for I don't know how long, but there's a lot of people that don't know that.
Mm-mm.
Yeah. So three women, Alaska Davidson, Jessie Duxton, and Lenora Houston, were made the first special agents, but Hoover would not tolerate women agents. So he made life for these three women pretty much nothing but hell, which forced them out of the FBI. And this left the FBI without any female agents for nearly 50 years. Because Hoover didn't believe the FBI was a place for women.
Of course not.
Yeah. So once the Equal Opportunity Employment Act was passed, Joanne and Suzanne broke through that ceiling. Women wanted to be a part of the FBI. And by the end of 1972, 11 women were sworn in as FBI agents. As of 2023, which were the last reported numbers that I could find, there are more than 3,200 women serving as FBI agents.
That's insane.
Yep. So to end Anne's stories, I'm going to tell you the tip, the one tip that Anne has told many in order to keep yourself safe. This is the only tip when she's asked, what can people do to keep themselves safe? She says, to always trust your gut. Quote, that's your limbic system reacting. It's an involuntary system that is set in us to alarm us, and you should pay attention to it. And that is the story of Anne Burgess, the psychiatric nurse who became a famous FBI profiler.
Damn, she did a lot.
Mm-hmm.
She did a lot.
Oh, yeah. In a time when that did not happen. Okay. This one is my favorite. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
This one's my favorite.
Oh, God.
For this one, we're going to go back to the year 1912. The day after Valentine's Day. It's a cold winter day in New York. Two young bank clerks that work at the East River National Bank in Lower Manhattan put on their coats and step outside into the cold. These two men just picked up a routine money transfer of $25,000, which would be over $81,000 today.
Damn.
So there's one man carrying this giant bag of money while the other walks ahead a little bit to open the door of a taxi cab that's waiting for them. This cabbie had been contracted through the bank to drive the clerks back and forth to make transfers, deposits, all of that, because they didn't have armored cars.
Mm-hmm.
They climb into the back of the cab. They throw the money onto the floor at their feet. The driver pulls into traffic. Things go as normal. That was until a man in a long black overcoat begins to walk alongside the slow-moving taxi. Although this man was very close to the cab, it didn't raise any alarms because it's New York. Traffic's always bad. So it's not odd that you see someone walking next to a car in the road. But then a second man shows up and he begins to walk along the opposite side of the cab from the other man. Suddenly, the two men open the doors to the cab. They jump into the back seat and begin to beat the young clerks. Once the two men are in the back seat, a third man shows up and jumps into the front seat. He holds a gun to the cabbie's head and tells him to drive to a nearby train station. Once there, they tell the cabbie to stop. They grab the bag of money, jump out of the cab, and disappear into the subway station. The cabbie is left unarmed, while the two clerks are left bloodied and bruised, and the money is long gone. The next morning, the heist is all over the news. It is a major headline. New Yorkers are stunned by the brutality, the boldness, and the amount of money stolen. Because that's a lot of money back then.
Yeah.
With this massive case all over the place, NYPD Deputy Commissioner George S. Daughtry, he knows that he has to close this case as soon as possible. Because at the same time that this is happening, the NYPD is trying to fix its horrific reputation, which I feel like they always have a bad reputation, but... So their office had been accused of corrupt and ineffective, of being corrupt and ineffective, which honestly, it's not a shock or anything new. Still happens today. Officers of the NYPD are known, even today, they are known for taking bribes and payouts from illicit businesses like gambling rings and brothels to keep from being shut down. Daughtry knows that the department can't afford to take any more dings on their reputation. So he assigned 60 detectives to the case. 60 detectives.
Did you say 60?
One case. Yeah. And wow. Thanks to the eyewitnesses, they are able to learn fast that there were three men involved in the heist. Days go by and they're not able to catch or even identify these men. And at this point, New Yorkers are saying that this is just another thing that points to the department's incompetence. Then suddenly, a tip comes in saying that one of the suspect's girlfriends was renting a room at a local seedy boarding house downtown. Daughtry thinks this girlfriend may just be the way that they catch these robbers. But getting close to a violent criminal's girlfriend isn't going to be easy and is going to require a very dangerous undercover operation. The detective assigned to this undercover op is going to need brains, courage, and creativity in order to avoid blowing their cover and get what the department needed. And obviously, no currently sworn in detective can be trusted to do any of those things. So the deputy commissioner decides to assign a very unlikely person to this very important and sensitive case, a woman. I'm going to tell you about a police matron turned detective who helped crack one of New York's most enthralling armed robbery cases when no man on the force could, and in the process, made history. This is the story of Isabella Goodwin, the NYPD's first female detective. So Isabella was born in February of 1865 in New York's Greenwich Village to Anna and James Laugry. They owned a very successful hotel and restaurant in the area. Their family was comfortable and happy. Isabel was filled with ambition and self-confidence as a child. She had dreams of one day becoming an opera singer. She was said to have had an invisible force and fearless quality about her, and that she wore it as if it was her own body's armor. As Isabel grew up, these qualities, along with her dreams and personal spark, remained. But it's the 1900s. And Isabel is coming of age during the 19th century. So it's impossible for her to escape the expectations that were placed on women in this era. So in 1884, at only 19 years old, she does what nearly all women did at this time. She got married and started a family. She married John W. Goodwin, a police officer with the NYPD. While he goes to work every day, Isabel is left at home to raise their four children by herself in their tiny apartment. In the mid-1880s, it becomes clear that John's income is not bringing in enough to sustain their family. The couple then decides to follow in the footsteps of Isabella's parents and they open a restaurant in Chelsea. But within 5 years of opening that restaurant, it burns to the ground. And worse than that, they had no insurance on the business.
Oh, God.
So it's a complete loss, and things only get worse from here. In 1889, after serving as an NYPD officer for more than 7 years, John had witnessed some serious corruption in his precinct. And he tells Isabel that he had threatened to expose what he knew. As a result of John's whistleblowing, his superiors tried to punish and even threaten John into staying silent. Isabella knew that John's job was all they had at that time, and it was already not enough. So, their family's struggling, and just when you think things can't get any worse, it does. But one afternoon, John is driving their carriage with a pregnant Isabella sitting by his side. They get into an accident. The carriage flips onto its side, and Isabella is thrown to the ground with the carriage landing on top of her, leaving her severely injured. Police show up, and Isabella is taken to the hospital. John is arrested by his own NYPD colleagues, who are accusing him of driving the carriage drunk. John fiercely denies this, but he's thrown into a cell anyway. John has no idea if his wife is alive or dead. And his fellow officers tell John the only way he's getting out of that cell is if he signs a resignation letter. So he signs it. For the next 7 weeks, Isabel remains in critical condition. She has 4 kids at home. She's lost her unborn child. Her husband now has no job. So in a very short time, Isabella has been through a lot. And eventually, she's released and is able to go home. At this point, her husband is now waging war against the NYPD over his wrongful termination. He's in court fighting a fierce battle. Newspapers have actually started calling him a hero cop who is willing to take down the city's corrupt department. And John's case actually ends up going to the state Supreme Court. In January of 1895, things seem for a moment to change for the Goodwin family when John wins his case against the NYPD. He's given his job back, but the stress from the last decade has really taken a toll. John's mental health has deteriorated, and he begins to drink a lot. So much so that he becomes a very serious alcoholic. And by the end of 1895, John is sent to Bellevue Hospital for treatment. The future president, Teddy Roosevelt, who at the time had recently started his tenure as the city's police commissioner, went as far as telling the newspaper, the New York Times, that the hero cop, John Goodwin, was now clinically insane. Yep. John continues to struggle with his medical and mental illness issues until August 11th, 1896, when he died from the side effects of alcoholism. So now Isabel is a widow and single mother of 4 children. She is grieving the loss of her husband and has no source of income. At the time, the NYPD offered some financial assistance to officers' widows, but it wasn't very much, and it definitely was not enough to support a family of 5. They did inform Isabella of a job opening for women, and with no other options, Isabella is now forced to seek employment from the same institution that, in a sense, killed her husband.
God, that'd be hard.
Yeah. I could not imagine. I don't know if I could do it.
Mm-mm.
Oof. So the job that Isabella is informed of and ultimately decides to apply for is police matron. This involves stepping in for male officers where a woman is needed instead, such as frisking a female suspect, bringing them food and water to the cells, and so on. Then in the 1890s, when women's groups began to advocate for more meaningful representation in American institutions. And so in response, Commissioner Roosevelt expands the job description. Now matrons are responsible for the welfare of any woman or child that comes into the station. Basically, they were social workers. So even though the NYPD had made Isabella aware of this job, she still had to make the cut. Over 200 women had applied for that job. And there were only 10 available positions. Yeah. Like, why would you not stop taking applications at some point?
Right.
Like, you have to cut 190 of those women out. In order to do that, the women had to pass multiple exams. And they were tough. Because it's the 1890s. There was a math and a written competency test, which most were going to fail right there because many girls weren't good at or just couldn't read, write, or do math in general. So that's at least half of your applicants gone. After that, there was a section on investigative and policing principles, along with a physical exam. Excuse me, how the fuck are these women supposed to know how to answer them questions?
Right. Never done any of that.
Exactly. How are they going to know how to investigate anything? Not only that, that's not in the job description. Why are you giving them an exam on investigating and that's not what they do? Make that make sense. Anyway, so in one section, Isabella has to decipher nearly illegible handwriting. And then in another, she has to explain how she would help a woman that suddenly went into labor under her watch.
What does that have to do with anything?
So, first, on this hand, okay, you have her trying to read handwriting that nobody else can read. Then on the other hand, you want her to tell you how she would help a woman that suddenly goes into labor. How are the two connected? Like, they don't have no, that's two totally different ends of the scale. Like, what?
Ugh.
Anyway, Isabel does a great job. Along with doing well on these exams, she submits 20 letters of recommendations from her well-respected friends.
Yeah.
In the end, 31-year-old Isabella, who stands at 5 foot tall, gets the job. She is offered a salary of $1,000 a year, which would be about $37,572 today. This was one of the lowest paid salaries in the entire NYPD, even less than the lowest ranking male officer.
Damn.
Yeah. This motherfucker over here makes more than her, and all he does is hand out mail.
Right.
Like, what? But she's fine with it because it's all she's got. It's better than nothing. So after she got her appointment, Teddy Roosevelt himself shook her hand and welcomed her to the force. Like, thanks, guy.
Yeah, slap in the face.
Yeah, fuck out of here. Her workday begins at 6 a.m. She tells her children goodbye, leaves them with her mother. She reports to a downtown police station. Isabella is now working in a gross, smelly, vicious boys' club. And she is the only woman in the entire station. So she is just thrown into the wolf's den. But she doesn't have time for any of it. Not the rudeness, the judgments, or how they underestimate her. Isabella clocks in at 6. She works 12-hour shifts, sometimes even pulling 24-hour shifts, depending on what's going on at the station. Along with this, she is also required to be on call at all times when she's not at the station and has to go in whenever she's needed, which includes being on call for the 7 days that she's allowed to take off every year. I'd be out right then. I'm off. Mm-hmm. I'm off. Don't call me in. Mm. All right. Especially exactly. I got 4 kids at home. Go on somewhere. It's my day off. Leave me alone.
Right.
So despite the long work hours and the demanding position, she holds. Nope. I'm not sure why that's there. Isabella loves her job and she is committed to serving others. At the station, she tends to women and children as if they were guests in her own home. Most of those under her care are despised by the public. Everyone from accused murderers to sex workers. Isabella watches over runaways, women who are homeless, and people trying to escape abusive situations. No matter their background, Isabella took care of them. She made sure they were comfortable, brushed their hair, asked them about their lives, and even though she hardly saw her own children, she happily cared for the children that, for one reason or another, ended up at the station. Because of her thoroughness, her intuitiveness, her patience, and how considerate she was, Isabel slowly began to accumulate more responsibilities. In 1904, she was given her first big opportunity when her police captain, a man named John Cottrell, gets a tip that a female-only gambling house is operating nearby. Cottrell knew that a male detective would not be able to infiltrate this gambling ring, but female detectives were not something that yet existed within the NYPD. So Cottrell called upon police matron Isabella Goodwin for help. He gives her the orders to find out where the house was located, how one got inside the gambling house, and to gather evidence of illegal activity. Isabel was excited, stoked, really. This job allowed her to be creative, strategic, and show what she can really do. So she puts together a plan. She knew in order to get in, she had to build up trust with the local gambling crowd, which mainly hung around downtown. So she began to make a daily appearance in the seedy downtown parts of the city. Right after she starts showing her face around, she starts carrying a copy of the Daily Racing Form under her arm, which this was the national tabloid newspaper, which heavily covered horse racing, which, you know, back then was the thing.
A big thing.
Everybody's out there, who's going to win the horse race? And even today, it's a really big gambling attraction, but I'm just like, who cares? I don't get it. Whatever. Teach their own. And within just a few days, her tactics paid off. A woman approached Isabel and asked her if she would be interested in attending a ladies-only betting club, to which she says yes. Isabella is then escorted into a discreet-looking building, and once inside, Isabella sees all sorts of illegal things going on. And as she's ordered, she reports everything back to Cottrell. A raid is arranged and executed. 15 people are arrested alongside Isabella to ensure her cover isn't blown. Which this was done at her request, not by the captains, because not only was this in her best interest, but it was also important to ensure her children's safety. Which obviously was a good call, because in the reporting by the New York Times, Isabella was named as a pivotal part of the investigation. This, of course, drew a lot of interest in and to Isabella, the police matron who made this bust rather than an actual detective. Like, could you imagine how those detectives felt?
Oh, I bet they were pissed.
Oh, like, I wish I could be a fly on the wall when they read that newspaper article. Oh. So thankfully, the Times didn't include a sketch of Isabella. So like everybody knew her name, but they didn't know what she looked like. So she was relieved about that, but she was even more excited because she's being validated. And she believed that their reporting meant there was hope that she would be given more undercover work. And she was right. Isabella was regularly asked to go undercover on cases where detectives needed to get inside female-dominated locations. She becomes known for her willingness to wear a disguise, learn an accent, and what was considered her chameleon-like ability to blend into a crowd. Isabella proved early on that she had the qualities that made a great detective. Along with her ability to blend in, she was courageous, and she had self-control, and the hardest of all was she was patient. With all these facts known about her, she soon had her own beat. Rather than chasing down gamblers just wanting to spend money, have a good time, she was out here busting charlatans and fraudsters. So instead of going after and taking down like the little guy, she was going after the big dogs. These included phony doctors, religious snake oil salesmen, and many phony psychics and mediums. So she was like, screw these little, you know.
Right.
guys over here.
She's going over the big ones.
Yeah, she wasn't joking. So Isabel worked long hours and on some very difficult and sometimes dangerous cases. Despite this, she was still just a police matron. But she quickly became the talk of the town. Isabel doesn't have a uniform or a badge. She doesn't have authority to carry a gun, and she can't arrest anyone. But each time she takes on a case, she is put into risky and at times dangerous situations with no form of protection. But she does it with no fear and accomplishes her mission each time. After a while, newspapers released a photo of Isabella, which would put her at an even greater risk when she went undercover, and there were a few times that her cover was nearly blown. And one of these times, she was trying to catch a phony surgeon. Isabel goes through the consultation process, schedules her procedure, and then shows up for that operation. She stays in character long enough that she is laid out on the table, and the fake doctor is ready to do the surgery.
Oh, hell no.
Right? Once she knows the doctor's actually going to go through with it, she jumps up and runs out of there before he can cut her open. That's how committed to this shit that she was.
Yeah, I'm good.
Me too. Like, mm-mm. We did the consultation. We scheduled the surgery. There you go. That's all you get.
There's your proof.
Yeah, like, I'm not taking our chances. During another job, Isabella was investigating a swindling fortune teller. Like, just the language tells you how old this fucking case is. Like, great. It's well known by this time that Isabella goes undercover. Oh, God. Nope. It's well known by this time that Isabella's go-to undercover operation were the ones that went after psychics and mediums. She was like, we ain't doing this. We ain't playing around with your horse shit. Okay? So when Isabella goes into the shop, she sits down with the fortune teller, who despite having, okay, she has a drawn sketch of Isabella hanging up in her shop. She has no idea that Isabella Goodwin is sitting in front of her.
She's not a good psychic.
Right? She tells Isabella, and, you know, she kind of points to the sketch, and she tells her that, oh, if this woman ever steps foot in my shop, then she wouldn't leave looking the way she did when she came in. She's sitting right in front of you, lady. What? So despite this, Isabella's amazing work and the glowing reputation that follows her, she still isn't considered to be on the same level as her male colleagues. Because, you know, of course not. Even though she's out here doing their job for them.
Right.
This would finally change, though, in February of 1912. 8 years after Isabella began working for the NYPD. That is after Isabella steps in to solve the bank heist that I told you about at the beginning. The three men that pulled off that heist are known criminals, and their names were Gene Blaine, Billy Keller, and Eddie Kinsman. Are you ready for their nicknames?
Oh, God.
They're great.
Oh, jeez.
Okay, the three are more common. I'm going to try to get through this without laughing. The three are more commonly known as the Parrot, Dutch, and the Boob, respectively.
The Boob? Wow, what nickname.
And the Boob ends up being a very important suspect. So the NYPD gets word that the Boob's girlfriend, a woman named Annie, was living in a downtown boarding house. So Deputy Commissioner Daughtry called on Isabella to break the case open. Isabella was asked to infiltrate the boarding house, gather evidence that linked the Boob to the stolen $25,000, and any indication that he had recently come into some money. An outright acknowledgement from Annie was ideal. and truly what they wanted. But all of this would at least get them closer to catching him. Because they highly doubted that Annie was just going to be like, oh, yeah, guess what the boob did yesterday, right, girl? You know, like. So Isabella gets to planting right away. She knows that she has to gain access to the house without raising suspicion. In order to do this, she goes and attempts to get a job inside the house. She tracks down the landlord and asks if he's looking for a housekeeper, which, by luck, he was. He offers Isabella a live-in cleaning job earning $6 a week, which today would be about $196. She accepts the job, moves in, gets to work straight away. According to reporting done by the New York Times, Isabella put on a ragged outfit, put on an Irish accent, and began snooping in between scrubbing floors and cooking meals. One day, Annie showed up wearing a beautiful and very expensive new suit. While Isabella was cleaning, she was also eavesdropping. She overheard Annie say, quote, Eddie the boob turned a trick.
Turned a trick.
Yep. I love the way they talk. It's just great. With this, Isabella feels that she's getting closer to linking the boob to the heist. But she doesn't have everything she needs just yet. So she begins to watch Annie closely. One afternoon, Annie leaves the boarding house. So Isabella slips into her room where she checks the tags on that new suit that she had been wearing. She is able to see where it was purchased from and passes that along to her contact. The cops go to the shop and they confirm that Eddie was the buyer. The shop owner tells police that Eddie was, quote, shedding money like a canary does feathers in the molting season. Like, why don't we talk like this today?
I know.
Like, it's just a fancy way of saying that he had a lot of money and he was spending it everywhere as fast as he could. But I like the way that the shop owner said it better.
The way he worded it?
Yes. Can we please go back to that? I love it. So, anyway. Now, Captain Cottrell has probable cause and he goes looking for Eddie the boob. To do this, he again turns to Isabella. One night, she goes to Annie's door and presses her ear against the keyhole where she hears Annie telling a friend about a trip that she and Eddie are taking to San Francisco. Isabella gains so much information from this eavesdropping session that when Annie and the boob arrive at Grand Central Station to buy their train tickets, they're arrested by the NYPD. Right away, the boob rats his friends out.
Well, of course.
Yep. So the boob is a rat. In the book, Women in Blue, Cheryl Mollenbeck wrote, quote, there was little honor among thieves and each ratted on each other. So as each ratted on the other, new players in the heist that police never suspected emerged.
Damn.
So it turns out the cabbie was in on the heist.
Of course.
Yep.
Go figure.
So eventually, everyone that's linked to the notorious taxi cab bank robbery is brought to court and each is convicted, giving the NYPD the win they needed. And none of it would have happened without Isabella Goodwin. And finally, after years of hard work and dedication, she is promoted and becomes the NYPD's first female detective.
Nice.
With this new promotion, her salary went from $1,000 to $2,250 a year, which today would be an increase from $32,536 to about $74,748 a year.
Damn.
Yeah. So while all this is going on at home for Isabel, nationwide, she has become a media sensation. The story of New York's first female detective is run all over the newspapers everywhere. The New York Herald reports, quote, there is many 6-foot detective with a gun on his hip who does less valuable work for his $3,300 a year than Mrs. Goodwin, a slight, quick-moving little woman whose brain more than she keeps pace with her body. Yeah, so even the newspaper is like, this fucking 5-foot tall lady over here does more than this motherfucker with a gun.
Yes, she's more badass.
Yeah. So about her new place in history, Isabella stated, quote, "I do not care for the distinction of being the first woman to become a member of the detective force. But I hope my work will be so successful that I will be known as one of the cleverest detectives in the department. I love the excitement, and I want to show just what a woman can do when the chance comes her way."
Well said.
All right. Over the next few years, more and more women appear to follow in Isabella's footsteps, and each joining the ranks of the NYPD. Then in 1921, Isabella, who is now 56, is told that she will be co-creating the NYPD's very first women's precinct, which is the complete opposite of where Isabella had been assigned to nearly two decades ago.
Right.
Well, you know, she was the only woman. Now it's all women. So the building where the women's precinct was located was described as a bright and cheerful place in Chelsea. It had a piano in the reception area. The detainee area had window boxes and white coverlets on the beds. Along with the piano in the reception area, there was a Persian rug, a snow-white desk topped with a vase of roses. The top officials of the police department said the team of female officers were valiant members of the force who were not just ready to stop crime, but also to prevent wrongdoing. I feel like you're just trying to butter somebody up. Why do you need all that? Why does a police station need a fucking piano?
Or a Persian rug?
Yeah, what? I do not understand that, but whatever. I feel like you're just trying to save face with somebody. But the women's precinct would only remain open for 2 years.
Of course.
1923, with no official explanation, the NYPD quietly closed it down. So I feel like, I'm going to be real, okay? I feel like they closed the precinct because they were fucking embarrassed.
Yeah.
The entire NYPD department had an awful reputation. They were incompetent. They were corrupt as fuck. These women are probably over here doing what the fuck they're supposed to be doing and are probably doing a way better job. So they're probably embarrassed because you're being shown up. I could be wrong, but I feel like that's what it was. So now it's 1921, and it was a significant year for Isabella. Aside from getting her own precinct, of course, this year was also the year that she married professional vocalist Oscar Seeholm, who, like Isabel, loved opera. She was 30 years older than Oscar.
Get it, girl?
Like, she's out here living her best life. Like, it's weird because, like, her kids are older than he is at this point, but she's living her best life. After a long career and after one last bust, where she took down a phony doctor, Isabella hung up her detective hat for good. She was now ready to retire and live a much-deserved quiet life, spending as much time as possible with her family. And that's exactly what she did until 1943, when she passed away from colon cancer at the age of 78.
Damn.
Mm-hmm. Which, that's a long time. I mean, that's the 40s. She was 78 when she died. It's a long time.
Yeah.
So that is the story of the NYPD's first female detective, Isabella Goodwin.
She was a badass.
Oh, yeah. That's why I said she's my favorite.
Yeah.
And that's it.
She was a good one.
That's the last episode for this month.
Nice.
Yep. I feel like we should end it on a good note.
A good one. Mm-hmm.
Isabella Goodwin has been on my list, like, since we started making, you know, a list for cases. She's been on it.
Mm-hmm.
I just was trying to figure out when.
Okay.
And Burgess, I just happened across her when I was looking up Isabella.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. I was like, oh, I'm going to do that one too. Because that's awesome. Yeah. All right. I don't have nothing else. That's it.
That's it.
All right. Next month, we don't have anything. The next month will just be random cases.
Yeah, I was going to say it's nothing special next month.
Not that I can think of. But May 25th is Missing Children's Day.
Oh, okay.
Yep. So all of May, we're going to do missing children cases.
That's going to be some hard ones.
Yep. I have
crazy.
Two they were found, and then two they weren't.
Mm-mm.
Yep. But I had sort of palate cleanser of sorts, because I have, so next month, we have a two-parter for next month that goes with Easter. We have a two-parter. And then I have another murder, and then one, it's like more like ancient true crime-ish. Mm-hmm. And then I have like a palate cleanser of sorts after those. Then we go into the missing children's. And then we'll probably end up doing like a palate cleanser sort of after those ones.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, because those are going to be rough.
Oh, yeah. I'm not sure which palate cleanser yet. I haven't picked it, but we'll probably do another one after that just because it's, you know, those ones are always rough and sad.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah. But I tried to make sure that I did two where they were found and returned home and two where they weren't. So that way, at least, you know, they had happy endings. Sort of. So. Okay. Yeah. I don't have nothing else. That's all I got.
All right.
All right. Well, as always, you can find the photos for this episode on our Facebook page. That link's in the episode description. Make sure you give us a rate and a review. Don't forget to subscribe if you get so you can get notifications when our new episode's released. Also, if you want to send us an email with a case suggestion, that is monstroustcpod@gmail.com. And then we hope you keep listening and remember to
watch for monsters.
Don't kill people. Bye, y'all.
Bye, y'all.